her faded sunbonnet hiding her bowed face. Scarlet saw with amazement that her percale dress had grease spots on it, and her hands were freckled and unclean. There were even black crescents under her fingernails. There was nothing of quality folks about Kathleen now. She looked cracker, even worse. She looked poor white, shiftless, slovenly, trifling. "She'll be dipping snuff soon, if she isn't doing it already," thought Scarlet in horror. Good Lord, what a come-down! She shuddered, turning her eyes from Kathleen as she realized how narrow was the chasm between quality folk and poor whites. "There, but for a lot of gumption, am I," she thought. And pride surged through her as she realized that she and Kathleen had started with the same equipment after the surrender, empty hands and what they had in their heads. "I haven't done so bad," she thought, lifting her chin and smiling. But she stopped in mid-smile as she saw the scandalized eyes of Mrs. Tarleton upon her. Her eyes were red-rimmed from tears, and after giving Scarlet a reproving look, she turned her gaze back to Sue Ellen, a fierce, angry gaze that boded ill for her. Behind her and her husband were the four Tarleton girls, their red locks in decorous notes in the solemn occasion, their russet eyes still looking like the eyes of vital young animals, spirited and dangerous. Feet were stilled, hats were removed, hands folded and skirts rustled into quietness as Ashley stepped forward with Corrine's worn Book of Devotions in his hand. He stood for a moment looking down, the sun glittering on his golden head. A deep silence fell on the crowd, so deep that the harsh whisper of the wind in the magnolia leaves came clear to their ears, and the far-off repetitious note of a mockingbird sounded unendurably loud and sad. Ashley began to read the prayers, and all the heads bowed, as his resonant, beautifully modulated voice rolled out the brief and dignified words. "Oh," thought Scarlet, her throat constricting, "how beautiful his voice is. If anyone has to do this for Pa, I'm glad it's Ashley. I'd rather have him than a priest. I'd rather have Pa buried by one of his own folks than a stranger." When Ashley came to the part of the prayers concerning the souls in purgatory, which Corrine had marked for him to read, he abruptly closed the book. Only Corrine noticed the omission and looked up puzzled as he began the Lord's Prayer. Ashley knew that half the people present had never heard of purgatory, and those who had would take it as a personal affront if he insinuated, even in prayer, that so fine a man as Mr. O'Hara had not gone straight to heaven. So, in deference to public opinion, he skipped all mention of purgatory. The gathering joined heartily in the Lord's Prayer, but their voices trailed off into embarrassed silence when he began the Hail Mary. They had never heard that prayer, and they looked furtively at each other as the O'Hara girls, Melanie, and the Terra servants gave the response. "Pray for us, now and at the hour of our death. Amen." Then Ashley raised his head and stood for a moment, uncertain. The eyes of the neighbors were expectantly upon him as they settled themselves in easier positions for a long harangue. They were waiting for him to go on with the service, for it didn't occur to any of them that he was at the end of the Catholic prayers. County funerals were always long. The Baptist and Methodist ministers who performed them had no set prayers, but extemporized as the circumstances demanded, and seldom stopped before all mourners were in tears, and the bereaved feminine relatives screaming with grief. The neighbors would have been shocked, aggrieved, and indignant, had these brief prayers been all the service over the body of their loved friend. And no one knew this better than Ashley. The matter would be discussed at dinner tables for weeks, and the opinion of the county would be that the O'Hara girls had not shown proper respect for their father. So he threw a quick apologetic glance at Corrine, and bowing his head again, began reciting from memory the Episcopal burial service which he had often read over slaves buried at Twelve Oaks. I am the resurrection and the life, and whosoever believeth in me shall never die. It didn't come back to him readily, and he spoke slowly, occasionally falling silent for a space as he waited for phrases to rise from his memory. But this measured delivery made his words more impressive, and mourners who had been dry-eyed before began now to reach for handkerchiefs. Sturdy Baptists and Methodists all, they thought it the Catholic ceremony, and immediately rearranged their first opinion that the Catholic services were cold and popish. Scarlett and Sue Ellen were equally ignorant and thought the words comforting and beautiful. Only Melanie and Corrine realized that a devoutly Catholic Irishman was being laid to rest by the Church of England service, and Corrine was too stunned by grief and her hurt at Ashley's treachery to interfere. When he had finished, Ashley opened wide his sad gray eyes and looked about the crowd. After a pause, his eyes caught those of Will, and he said, "Is there anyone present who would like to say a word?" Mrs. Tarleton twitched nervously, but before she could act, Will stumped forward and, standing at the head of the coffin, began to speak. "Friends," he began in his flat, pale voice. "Maybe you think I'm getting above myself speaking first. Me who never knew Mr. O'Hara till about a year ago, when you all have known him 20 years or more. But this here is my excuse. If he'd lived a month or so longer, I'd have had the right to call him Pa." A startled ripple went over the crowd. They were too well-bred to whisper, but they shifted on their feet and stared at Corrine's bowed head. Everyone knew his dumb devotion to her. Seeing the direction in which all eyes were cast, Will went on as if he had taken no note. "So being as how I'm to marry Miss Sue Ellen as soon as the priest comes down from Atlanta, I thought maybe that gives me the right to speak first." The last part of his speech was lost in a faint sibilant buzz that went through the gathering, an angry bee-like buzz. There was indignation and disappointment in the sound. Everyone liked Will. Everyone respected him for what he had done for Tara. Everyone knew his affections lay with Corrine, so the news that he was to marry the neighborhood pariah instead sat ill upon them. Good old Will marrying that nasty, sneaking little Sue Ellen O'Hara. For a moment the air was tense. Mrs. Tarleton's eyes began to snap and her lips to shape soundless words. In the silence, old man McRae's high voice could be heard imploring his grandson to tell him what had been said. Will faced them all, still mild of face. But there was something in his pale blue eyes which dared them to say one word about his future wife. For a moment the balance hung between the honest affection everyone had for Will and their contempt for Sue Ellen. And Will won. He continued as if his pause had been a natural one. "I never knew Mr. O'Hara in his prime like you all done. All I knew personally was a fine old gentleman who was a mite addled. But I've heard tell from you all about what he used to be like, and I want to say this. He was a fighting Irishman and a southern gentleman and as loyal a Confederate as ever lived. You can't get no better combination than that. And we ain't likely to see many more like him, because the times that bred men like him are as dead as he is. He was born in a foreign country, but the man we're burying here today was more of a Georgian than any of us mourning him. He lived our life. He loved our land, and when you come right down to it, he died for our cause, same as the soldiers did. He was one of us, and he had our good points and our bad points, and he had our strength and he had our failings. He had our good points in that couldn't nothing stop him when his mind was made up, and he weren't scared of nothing that walked in shoe leather. There weren't nothing that come to him from the outside that could lick him. He weren't scared of the English government when they wanted to hang him. He just lit out and left home. And when he come to this country and was poor, that didn't scare him a mite neither. He went to work and he made his money. And he weren't scared to tackle this section when it was part wild and the engines had just been run out of it. He made a big plantation out of a wilderness. And when the war come on and his money begun to go, he weren't scared to be poor again. And when the Yankees come through Terra and might have burned him out or killed him, he weren't fazed a bit and he weren't licked neither. He just planted his front feet and stood his ground. That's why I say he had our good points. There ain't nothing from the outside can lick any of us. But he had our failings, too, 'cause he could be licked from the inside. I mean to say that what the whole world couldn't do, his own heart could. When Mrs. O'Hara died, his heart died, too, and he was licked. And what we seen walking round here weren't him. Will paused, and his eyes went quietly around the circle of faces. The crowd stood in the hot sun as if enchanted to the ground, and whatever wrath they had felt for Sue Ellen was forgotten. Will's eyes rested for a moment on Scarlet, and they crinkled slightly at the corners, as if he were inwardly smiling comfort to her. Scarlet, who had been fighting back rising tears, did feel comforted. Will was talking common sense instead of a lot of tootle about reunions in another and better world, and submitting her will to God's. And Scarlet had always found strength and comfort in common sense. "And I don't want none of you to think the less of him for breaking like he done. All you all, and me too, are like him. We got the same weakness and failing. There ain't nothing that walks can lick us any more than it could lick him. Not Yankee, nor carpetbaggers, nor hard times, nor high taxes, nor even downright starvation. But that weakness that's in our hearts can lick us in the time it takes to bat your eye. It ain't always losing someone you love that does it, like it done Mr. O'Hara. Everybody's mainspring is different. And I want to say this. Folks whose mainsprings are busted are better dead. They ain't no place for them in the world these days. And they're happier being dead. That's why I'm saying you all ain't got no cause to grieve for Mr. O'Hara now. The time to grieve was back when Sherman come through and he lost Mrs. O'Hara. Now that his body's gone to join his heart, I don't see that we got reason to mourn. Unless we're pretty damn selfish. And I'm saying it who loved him like he was my own pa. There won't be no more words said, if you folks don't mind. The family's too cut up to listen, and it wouldn't be no kindness to them. Will stopped, and turning to Mrs. Tarleton, he said in a lower voice, "I wonder, couldn't you take Scarlet in the house, ma'am? It ain't right for her to be standing in the sun so long. And Grandma Fontaine don't look any too pert neither, meaning no disrespect." Startled at the abrupt switching from the eulogy to herself, Scarlet went red with embarrassment as all eyes turned toward her. Why should Will advertise her already obvious pregnancy? She gave him a shamed, indignant look, but Will's placid gaze bore her down. "Please," his look said, "I know what I'm doing." Already he was the man of the house, and not wishing to make a scene, Scarlet turned helplessly to Mrs. Tarleton. That lady suddenly diverted, as Will had intended, from thoughts of Sue Ellen to the always fascinating matter of breeding, be it animal or human, took Scarlet's arm. "Come in the house, honey," Her face took on a look of kind, absorbed interest, and Scarlet suffered herself to be led through the crowd that gave way and made a narrow path for her. There was a sympathetic murmuring as she passed, and several hands went out to pat her comfortingly. When she came abreast Grandma Fontaine, the old lady put out a skinny claw and said, "Give me your arm, child," and added with a fierce glance at Sally and young Miss, "No, don't you come. I don't want you." They passed slowly through the crowd, which closed behind them, and went up the shady path toward the house, Mrs. Tarleton's eager helping hand so strong under Scarlet's elbow that she was almost lifted from the ground at each step. "Now why did Will do that?" cried Scarlet heatedly, when they were out of earshot. "He practically said, 'Look at her, she's going to have a baby.' "Well, sakes alive, you are, aren't you?" said Mrs. Tarleton. "Will did right. It was foolish of you to stand in the hot sun when you might have fainted and had a miscarriage." "Will wasn't bothered about her miscarrying," said Grandma, a little breathless as she labored across the front yard toward the steps. There was a grim, knowing smile on her face. "Will's smart. He didn't want either you or me, Beatrice, at the graveside. He was scared of what we'd say, and he knew this was the only way to get rid of us. And it was more than that. He didn't want Scarlet to hear the clods dropping on the coffin. And he's right. Just remember, Scarlet, as long as you don't hear that sound, folks aren't actually dead to you, but won't you hear it? Well, it's the most dreadfully final sound in the world. Help me up the steps, child. Give me a hand, Beatrice. Scarlet don't any more need your arm than she needs crutches, and I'm not so pert, as Will observed. Will knew you were your father's pet, and he didn't want to make it worse for you than it already was. He figured it wouldn't be so bad for your sisters. Sue Ellen has her shame to sustain her and Corrine her god. But you've got nothing to sustain you, have you, child?" "No," answered Scarlet, helping the old lady up the steps, faintly surprised at the truth that sounded in the reedy old voice. "I've never had anything to sustain me, except Mother." "But when you lost her, you found you could stand alone, didn't you?" "Well, some folks can't. Your pa was one. Will's right. Don't you grieve. He couldn't get along without Ellen, and he's happier where he is. Just like I'll be happier when I join the old doctor." She spoke without any desire for sympathy, and the two gave her none. She spoke as briskly and naturally as if her husband were alive and in Jonesboro, and a short buggy ride would bring them together. Grandma was too old and had seen too much to fear death. "But you can stand alone, too," said Scarlet. The old lady gave her a bright, bird-like glance. "Yes. But it's powerful uncomfortable at times." "Look here, Grandma," interrupted Mrs. Tarleton. "You ought not to talk to Scarlet like that. She's upset enough already. What with her trip down here and that tight dress and her grief and the heat, she's got enough to make her miscarry without your adding to it, talking grief and sorrow." "God's nightgown," cried Scarlet in irritation. "I'm not upset. And I'm not one of those sickly miscarrying fools."
"You never can tell," said Mrs. Tarleton omnisciently. "I lost my first when I saw a bull gore one of our darkies, and you remember my red mare, Nellie? Now, there was the healthiest-looking mare you ever saw, but she was nervous and high-strung, and if I didn't watch her, she'd—"
"Beatrice, hush," said Grandma. "Scarlet wouldn't miscarry on a bet. Let's us sit here in the hall where it's cool. There's a nice draft through here. Now you go fetch us a glass of buttermilk, Beatrice, if there's any in the kitchen. Or look in the pantry and see if there's any wine. I could do with a glass. We'll sit here till the folks come up to say goodbye."
"Scarlet ought to be in bed," insisted Mrs. Tarleton,
running her eyes over her with the expert air of one who calculated a pregnancy to the last minute of its length. "Get going," said Grandma, giving her a prod with her cane. And Mrs. Tarleton went through the kitchen, throwing her hat carelessly on the sideboard and running her hands through her damp red hair. Scarlet lay back in her chair and unbuttoned the two top buttons of her tight basque. It was cool and dim in the high-ceilinged hall, and the vagrant draft that went from back to front of the house was refreshing after the heat of the sun. She looked across the hall into the parlor where Gerald had lain, and, wrenching her thoughts from him, looked up at the portrait of Grandma Robillard hanging above the fireplace. The bayonet-scarred portrait with its high-piled hair, half-exposed breasts, and cool insolence had, as always, a tonic effect upon her. "I don't know which hit Beatrice Tarleton worse, losing her boys or her horses," said Grandma Fontaine. "She never did pay much mind to Jim or her girls, you know. She's one of those folks Will was talking about. Her mainspring's busted. Sometimes I wonder if she won't go the way your pa went. She wasn't ever happy unless horses or humans were breeding right in her face, and none of her girls are married or got any prospects of catching husbands in this county. So she's got nothing to occupy her mind. If she wasn't such a lady at heart, she'd be downright common. Was Will telling the truth about marrying Sue Ellen?"
"Yes," said Scarlet, looking the old lady full in the eye. Goodness, she could remember the time when she was scared to death of Grandma Fontaine. "Well, she'd grown up since then, and she'd just as soon as not tell her go to the devil if she meddled in affairs at Terra."
"It could do better," said Grandma candidly.
"Indeed," said Scarlet haughtily. "Come off your high horse, miss," said the old lady tartly. "I shan't attack your precious sister, though I might have if I'd stayed at the burying ground. What I mean is, with a scarcity of men in the neighborhood, Will could marry most any of the girls. There's Beatrice Four Wildcats and the Monroe girls and the McRae. He's going to marry Sue, and that's that. She's lucky to get him. Tara is lucky to get him."
"You love this place, don't you?"
"Yes.
So much that you don't mind your sister marrying out of a class as long as you have a man around to care for Tara."
"Class?" said Scarlet, startled at the idea. "Class? What does class matter now so long as a girl gets a husband who can take care of her?"
"That's a debatable question," said Old Miss. "Some folks would say you were talking common sense. Others would say you were letting down bars that ought never to be lowered one inch. Well, certainly not quality folks, and some of your people were."
Her sharp old eyes went to the portrait of Grandma Robillard. Scarlet thought of Will, lank, unimpressive, mild, eternally chewing a straw, his whole appearance deceptively devoid of energy, like that of most crackers. He didn't have behind him a long line of ancestors of wealth, prominence, and blood. The first of Will's family to set foot on Georgia soil might even have been one of Oglethorpe's debtors or a bondservant. Will had not been to college. In fact, 4 years in a backwoods school was all the education he had ever had. He was honest and he was loyal. He was patient and he was hard-working, but certainly he was not quality. Undoubtedly, by Robillard standards, Sue Ellen was coming down in the world. "So you approve of Will coming into your family?"
"Yes," answered Scarlet fiercely, ready to pounce upon the old lady at the first words of condemnation.
"You may kiss me," said Grandma surprisingly, and she smiled in her most approving manner. "I never liked you much till now, Scarlet.
You were always hard as a hickory nut, even as a child, and I don't like hard females, barring myself. But I do like the way you meet things. You don't make a fuss about things that can't be helped, even if they are disagreeable. You take your fences cleanly, like a good hunter. Scarlet smiled uncertainly, and pecked obediently at the withered cheek presented to her. It was pleasant to hear approving words again, even if she had little idea what they meant. There's plenty of folks hereabout who'll have something to say about you letting Sue marry a cracker. For all that everybody likes Will, they'll say in one breath what a fine man he is and how terrible it is for an O'Hara girl to marry beneath her. But don't you let it bother you.
I've never been bothered about what people said.
So I've heard. There was a hint of acid in the old voice. Well, don't bother about what folks say. It'll probably be a very successful marriage. Of course, Will's always going to look like a cracker, and marriage won't improve his grammar any. And even if he makes a mint of money, he'll never lend any shine and sparkle to Tara like your father did. Crackers are short on sparkle. But Will's a gentleman at heart. He's got the right instincts. Nobody but a born gentleman could have put his finger on what's wrong with us as accurately as he just did, down there at the burying. The whole world can't lick us, but we can lick ourselves by longing too hard for things we haven't got any more, and by remembering too much. Yes, Will will do well by Sue Ellen and by Tara.
Then you approve of me letting him marry her?
God, no! The old voice was tired and bitter, but vigorous. Approve of crackers marrying into old families? Bah! Would I approve of breeding scrub stock to thoroughbreds? Oh, crackers are good and solid and honest, but...
But you just said you thought it would be a successful match, cried Scarlet, bewildered.
Oh, I think it's good for Sue Ellen to marry Will. To marry anybody, for that matter, because she needs a husband bad. And where else could she get one? And where else could you get as good a manager for Tara? But that doesn't mean I like the situation any better than you do.
But I do like it, thought Scarlet, trying to grasp the old lady's meaning. I'm glad Will is going to marry her. Why should she think I'm minded? She's taking it for granted that I do mind, just like her. She felt puzzled and a little ashamed. As always, when people attributed to her emotions and motives they possessed and thought she shared. Grandma fanned herself with her palmetto leaf and went on briskly. I don't approve of the match any more than you do, but I'm practical, and so are you. And when it comes to something that's unpleasant but can't be helped, I don't see any sense in screaming and kicking about it. That's no way to meet the ups and downs of life. I know because my family and the old doctor's family have had more than our share of ups and downs. And if we folks have a motto, it's this. Don't holler, smile, and bide your time. We've survived a passel of things that way, smiling and biding our time, and we've gotten to be experts at surviving. We had to be. We've always bet on the wrong horses. Run out of France with the Huguenots, run out of England with the Cavaliers, run out of Scotland with Bonnie Prince Charlie, run out of Haiti by the niggers and now licked by the Yankees. But we always turn up on top in a few years. You know why? She cocked her head, and Scarlet thought she looked like nothing so much as an old, knowing parrot. No, I don't know, I'm sure, she answered politely. But she was heartily bored, even as she had been the day when Grandma launched on her memories of the Creek uprising.
Well, this is the reason. We bow to the inevitable. We're not wheat, we're buckwheat. When a storm comes along, it flattens ripe wheat because it's dry and can't bend with the wind. But ripe buckwheat's got sap in it, and it bends. And when the wind has passed, it springs up almost as straight and strong as before. We aren't a stiff-necked tribe. We're mighty limber when a hard wind's blowing.
because we know it pays to be limber. When trouble comes, we bow to the inevitable without any mouthing, and we work and we smile and we bide our time. And we play along with lesser folks, and we take what we can get from them. And when we're strong enough, we kick the folks whose necks we've climbed over. That, my child, is the secret of the survival. And after a pause, she added, I pass it on to you. The old lady cackled, as if she were amused by her words, despite the venom in them. She looked as if she expected some comment from Scarlet, but the words had made little sense to her, and she could think of nothing to say. No, sir, old Miss went on. Our folks get flattened out, but they rise up again, and that's more than I can say for plenty of people not so far away from here. Look at Kathleen Calvert. You can see what she's come to. Poor white. And a heap lower than the man she married. Look at the McCrae family. Flat to the ground, helpless, don't know what to do, don't know how to do anything. Won't even try. They spend their time whining about the good old days. And look at, well, look at nearly everybody in this county except my Alex and my Sally and you and Jim Tarleton and his girls and some others. The rest have gone under because they didn't have any sap in them, because they didn't have the gumption to rise up again. There never was anything to those folks but money and darkies. And now that the money and darkies are gone, those folks will be cracker in another generation.
You forgot the Wilkes.
No, I didn't forget them. I just thought I'd be polite and not mention them, seeing that Ashley's a guest under this roof. But seeing as how you've brought up their names, look at them. There's India, who, from all I hear, is a dried-up old maid already, giving herself all kinds of widowed airs because Stu Tarleton was killed, and not making any effort to forget him and try to catch another man. Of course, she's old, but she could catch some widower with a big family if she tried. And poor Honey was always a man-crazy fool with no more sense than a guinea hen. And as for Ashley, look at him. Ashley is a very fine man, began Scarlet hotly. I never said he wasn't, but he's as helpless as a turtle on his back. If the Wilkes' family pulls through these hard times, it'll be Melly who pulls them through, not Ashley.
Melly? Lord, Grandma, what are you talking about? I've lived with Melly long enough to know she's sickly and scared and hasn't the gumption to say boo to a goose.
Now, why on earth should anyone want to say boo to a goose? It always sounded like a waste of time to me. She might not say boo to a goose, but she'd say boo to the world, or to the Yankee government, or anything else that threatened her precious Ashley, or her boy, or her notions of gentility. Her way isn't your way, Scarlet, or my way. It's the way your mother would have acted if she'd lived. Melly puts me in mind of your mother when she was young. And maybe she'll pull the Wilkes family through.
Oh, Melly's a well-meaning little ninny. But you are very unjust to Ashley. He's,
oh, foot. Ashley was bred to read books and nothing else. That doesn't help a man pull himself out of a tough fix, like we're all in now. From what I hear, he's the worst plowhand in the county. Now you just compare him with my Alex. Before the war, Alex was the most worthless dandy in the world, and he never had a thought beyond a new cravat and getting drunk and shooting somebody and chasing girls who were no better than they should be. But look at him now. He's learned farming because he's had to learn. He'd have starved, and so would all of us. Now he raises the best cotton in the county. Yes, miss. It's a heap better than Terra cotton. And he knows what to do with hogs and chickens. Ha! He's a fine boy for all his bad temper. He knows how to bide his time and change with changing ways. And when all this Reconstruction misery is over, you're going to see my Alex as rich a man as his father and his grandfather were. But Ashley... Scarlet was smarting at the slight to Ashley.
It all sounds like tootle to me,
she said coldly.
"Well, it shouldn't," said Grandma, fastening a sharp eye upon her. "For it's just exactly the course you've been following since you went to Atlanta."
"Oh, yes. We hear of your didos, even if we are buried down here in the country. You've changed with the changing times, too. We hear how you suck up to the Yankees and the white trash and the new rich carpetbaggers to get money out of them. Butter doesn't melt in your mouth from all I can hear." "Well, go to it, I say. And get every cent out of them you can. But when you've got enough money, kick them in the face, because they can't serve you any longer. Be sure you do that, and do it properly, for trash hanging on your coattails can ruin you."
Scarlet looked at her, her brow wrinkling with the effort to digest the words. They still didn't make much sense, and she was still angry at Ashley being called a turtle on his back.
"I think you're wrong about Ashley," she said abruptly.
"Scarlet, you just aren't smart."
"That's your opinion," said Scarlet rudely, wishing it were permissible to smack old lady's jaws.
"Oh, you're smarting up about dollars and cents. That's a man's way of being smart. But you aren't smart at all like a woman. You aren't a speck smart about folks."
Scarlet's eyes began to snap fire, and her hands to clench and unclench.
"I've made you good and mad, haven't I?" asked the old lady, smiling.
"Well, I aim to do just that."
"Oh, you did you? And why, pray?"
"I had good and plenty reasons."
Grandma sank back in her chair, and Scarlet suddenly realized that she looked very tired and incredibly old. The tiny claw-like hands folded over the fan were yellow and waxy as a dead person's. The anger went out of Scarlet's heart as a thought came to her. She leaned over and took one of the hands in hers.
"You're a mighty sweet old liar," she said. "You didn't mean a word of all this rigmarole."
"You've just been talking to keep my mind off Pa, haven't you?"
"Don't you fiddle with me," said old Miss grumpily, jerking away her hand. "Partly for that reason. Partly because what I've been telling you is the truth, and you're just too stupid to realize it."
But she smiled a little, and took the sting from her words. Scarlet's heart emptied itself of wrath about Ashley. It was nice to know Grandma hadn't meant any of it.
"Thank you just the same. It was nice of you to talk to me. And I'm glad to know you're with me about Will and Sue Ellen, even if a lot of other people do disapprove."
Mrs. Tarleton came down the hall, carrying two glasses of buttermilk. She did all domestic things badly, and the glasses were slopping over.
"I had to go clear to the spring house to get it," she said. "Drink it quick, because the folks are coming up from the burying ground. Scarlet, are you really going to let Sue Ellen marry Will? Not that he isn't a sight too good for her, but, you know, he is a cracker, and..."
Scarlet's eyes met those of Grandma. There was a wicked sparkle in the old eyes that found an answer in her own.
Chapter 41. When the last goodbye had been said, and the last sound of wheels and hooves died away, Scarlet went into Ellen's office and removed a gleaming object from where she had hidden it the night before, between the yellowed papers in the pigeonholes of the secretary. Hearing Pork sniffling in the dining room as he went about laying the table for dinner, she called to him. He came to her, his black face as forlorn as a lost and masterless hound.
"Pork," she said sternly, "you cry just once more and I'll cry too. You've got to stop."
"Yes'm. I try, but every time I try, I think of Mr. Gerald and...
Well, don't think. I can stand everybody else's tears, but not yours.
There. She broke off gently.
Don't you see?
I can't stand yours because I know how you loved him.
Blow your nose, Pork. I've got a present for you.
A little interest flickered in Pork's eyes as he blew his nose loudly, but it was more politeness than interest.
You remember that night you got shot robbing somebody's hen house?
Lord God, Miss Scarlet, I ain't never...
Well, you did, so don't lie to me about it at this late date. You remember I said I was going to give you a watch for being so faithful?
Yasm, I'm members. I figured you'd done forgot.
No, I didn't forget, and here it is.
She held out for him a massive gold watch, heavily embossed, from which dangled a chain with many fobs and seals.
"For God, Miss Scarlet," cried Pork. "That's Mr. Gerald's watch. I done seen him look at that watch a million times."
"Yes, it's Pa's watch, Pork, and I'm giving it to you. Take it."
"Oh, no," Pork retreated in horror. "That's a white gentleman's watch, and Mr. Gerald's to boot. How come you talk about giving it to me, Miss Scarlet? That watch belong by rights to little Wade Hampton."
"It belongs to you. What did Wade Hampton ever do for Pa? Did he look after him when he was sick and feeble? Did he bathe him and dress him and shave him? Did he stick by him when the Yankees came? Did he steal for him? Don't be a fool, Pork. If ever anyone deserved a watch, you do, and I know Pa would approve. Here."
She picked up the black hand and laid the watch in the palm. Pork gazed at it reverently, and slowly delight spread over his face.
"For me, truly, Miss Scarlet?"
"Yes, indeed."
"Well, thank you, ma'am."
"Would you like for me to take it to Atlanta and have it engraved?"
"What's this engraved mean?"
Pork's voice was suspicious.
"It means to put writing on the back of it, like to Pork from the O'Haras, well done, good and faithful servant."
"No, thank you, ma'am. Never mind the engraving."
Pork retreated a step, clutching the watch firmly. A little smile twitched her lips.
"What's the matter, Pork? Don't you trust me to bring it back?"
"Yasm, I trust you. Only, well, you might change your mind."
"I wouldn't do that."
"Well, you might sell it. I expect it's worth a heap."
"You think I'd sell Pa's watch?"
"Yasm, if you needed the money."
"You ought to be beat for that, Pork. I've a mind to take the watch back."
"No, you ain't."
The first faint smile of the day showed on Pork's grief-worn face.
"I knows you. And Miss Scarlet..."
"Yes, Pork?"
"If you was just half as nice to white folks as you is to niggers, I expect the world would treat you better."
"It treats me well enough," she said. "Now go find Mr. Ashley and tell him I want to see him here right away."
Ashley sat on Ellen's little writing chair, his long body dwarfing the frail bit of furniture while Scarlet offered him a half-interest in the mill. Not once did his eyes meet hers, and he spoke no word of interruption. He sat looking down at his hands, turning them over slowly, inspecting first palms and then backs, as though he had never seen them before. Despite hard work, they were still slender and sensitive-looking and remarkably well-tended for a farmer's hands. His bowed head and silence disturbed her a little, and she redoubled her efforts to make the mill sound attractive. She brought to bear, too, all the charm of smile and glance she possessed, but they were wasted, for he didn't raise his eyes. If he would only look at her! She made no mention of the information Will had given her of Ashley's determination to go north, and spoke with the outward assumption that no obstacle stood in the way of his agreement with her plan. Still, he didn't speak. And finally, her words trailed into silence. There was a determined squareness about his slender shoulders that alarmed her. Surely he wouldn't refuse. What earthly reason could he have for refusing?
"Ashley," she began again and paused.
She had not intended using her pregnancy as an argument, had shrunk from the thought of Ashley even seeing her so bloated and ugly. But as her other persuasion seemed to have made no impression, she decided to use it and her helplessness as a last card.
"You must come to Atlanta. I do need your help so badly now because I can't look after the mills. It may be months before I can because, you see, well, because..."
"Please," he said roughly. "Good God, Scarlet!"
He rose and went abruptly to the window and stood with his back to her, watching the solemn single file of ducks parade across the barnyard.
Is that why you won't look at me?"
she questioned forlornly.
"I know I look..."
He swung around in a flash, and his gray eyes met hers with an intensity that made her hands go to her throat.
"Damn your looks," he said with swift violence. "You know you always look beautiful to me." Happiness flooded her, until her eyes were liquid with tears. "How sweet of you to say that, for I was so ashamed to let you see me."
"You? Ashamed? Why should you be ashamed? I'm the one to feel shame, and I do. If it hadn't been for my stupidity, you wouldn't be in this fix. You'd never have married Frank. I should never have let you leave Tara last winter. Oh, fool that I was. I should have known you were desperate, so desperate that you'd... I should have...
His face went haggard. Scarlett's heart beat wildly. She was regretting that he had not run away with her.
"The least I could have done was go out and commit highway robbery or murder to get the tax money for you when you had taken us in as beggars. Oh, I messed it up all the way around."
Her heart contracted with disappointment, and some of the happiness went from her, for these were not the words she hoped to hear.
"I would have gone anyway," she said tiredly. "I couldn't have let you do anything like that. And anyway, it's done now."
"Yes, it's done now," he said with slow bitterness. "You wouldn't have let me do anything dishonorable, but you would sell yourself to a man you didn't love and bear his child so that my family and I wouldn't starve. It was kind of you to shelter my helplessness."
The edge in his voice spoke of a raw, unhealed wound that ached within him, and his words brought shame to her eyes. He was swift to see it, and his face changed to gentleness.
"You didn't think I was blaming you? Dear God, Scarlet, no. You are the bravest woman I've ever known. It's myself I'm blaming."
He turned and looked out of the window again, and the shoulders presented to her gaze did not look quite so square. Scarlet waited a long moment in silence, hoping that Ashley would return to the mood in which he spoke of her beauty, hoping he would say more words that she could treasure. It had been so long since she had seen him, and she had lived on memories until they were worn thin. She knew he still loved her. That fact was evident in every line of him, in every bitter self-condemnatory word, in his resentment at her bearing Frank's child. She so longed to hear him say it in words, longed to speak words herself that would provoke a confession. But she dared not. She remembered her promise given last winter in the orchard, that she would never again throw herself at his head. Sadly, she knew that promise must be kept if Ashley were to remain near her.
One cry from her of love and longing, one look that pleaded for his arms, and the matter would be settled forever. Ashley would surely go to New York, and he must not go away. Oh, Ashley, don't blame yourself. How could it be your fault? You will come to Atlanta and help me, won't you?
No.
But Ashley! Her voice was beginning to break with anguish and disappointment. But I'd counted on you. I do need you so. Frank can't help me. He's so busy with the store. And if you don't come, I don't know where I can get a man. Everybody in Atlanta who's smart is busy with his own affairs, and the others are so incompetent and...
It's no use, Scarlett.
You mean you'd rather go to New York and live among Yankees than come to Atlanta? Who told you that?
He turned and faced her, faint annoyance wrinkling his forehead.
Will?
Yes. I've decided to go north. An old friend who made the grand tour with me before the war has offered me a position in his father's bank.
It's better so, Scarlett.
I'd be no good to you. I know nothing of the lumber business.
But you know less about banking, and it's much harder. And I know I'd make far more allowances for your inexperience than Yankees would.
He winced, and she knew she had said the wrong thing. He turned and looked out of the window again. I don't want allowances made for me. I want to stand on my own feet for what I'm worth. What have I done with my life up till now? It's time I made something of myself. I went down through my own fault. I've been your pensioner too long already.
But I'm offering you a half interest in the mill, Ashley. You would be standing on your own feet, because, you see, it would be your own business.
It would amount to the same thing. I'd not be buying the half interest, I'd be taking it as a gift. And I've taken too many gifts from you already, Scarlett. Food and shelter and even clothes for myself and Melanie and the baby. And I've given you nothing in return.
Oh, but you have. Will couldn't...
I can split kindling very nicely now.
Oh, Ashley!
She cried despairingly. Tears in her eyes at the jeering note in his voice.
What has happened to you since I've been gone? You sound so hard and bitter. You didn't used to be this way.
What's happened? A very remarkable thing, Scarlett. I've been thinking. I don't believe I really thought from the time of the surrender until you went away from here. I was in a state of suspended animation, and it was enough that I had something to eat and a bed to lie on. But when you went to Atlanta, shouldering a man's burden, I saw myself as much less than a man. Much less, indeed, than a woman. Such thoughts aren't pleasant to live with, and I do not intend to live with him any longer. Other men came out of the war with less than I had, and look at them now. So I'm going to New York.
But I don't understand. If it's work you want, why won't Atlanta do as well as New York? And my meal...
No, Scarlett. This is my last chance. I'll go north. If I go to Atlanta and work for you, I'm lost forever. The word lost, lost, lost dinged frighteningly in her heart like a death bell sounding. Her eyes went quickly to his, but they were wide and crystal gray, and they were looking through her and beyond her at some fate she could not see, could not understand.
Lost? Do you mean... Have you done something the Atlanta Yankees can get you for? I mean, about helping Tony get away, or Ashley? You aren't in the Ku Klux, are you?
His remote eyes came back to her swiftly, and he smiled a brief smile that never reached his eyes. I had forgotten you were so literal.
No,
it's not the Yankees I'm afraid of. I mean, if I go to Atlanta and take help from you again.
I bury forever any hope of ever standing alone.
Oh, she sighed in quick relief. If it's only that.
Yes. And he smiled again, the smile more wintry than before. Only that. Only my masculine pride, my self-respect, and if you choose to so call it, my immortal soul.
But she swung around on another tack. You could gradually buy the mill from me, and it would be your own, and then...
Scarlet, he interrupted fiercely, I tell you, no. There are other reasons.
What reasons?
You know my reasons better than anyone in the world.
Oh, that? But that'll be all right, she assured swiftly. I promised, you know, out in the orchard last winter, and I'll keep my promise and...
Then you are surer of yourself than I am. I could not count on myself to keep such a promise.
I should not have said that.
But I had to make you understand. Scarlet, I will not talk of this any more. It's finished. When Will and Sue Ellen marry, I'm going to New York. His eyes, wide and stormy, met hers for an instant. And then he went swiftly across the room. His hand was on the doorknob. Scarlet stared at him in agony. The interview was ended, and she had lost.
Suddenly weak from the strain and sorrow of the day and the present disappointment, her nerves broke abruptly, and she screamed, "Oh, Ashley!" And flinging herself down on the sagging sofa, she burst into wild crying. She heard his uncertain footsteps leaving the door and his helpless voice saying her name over and over above her head. There was a swift pattering of feet racing up the hall from the kitchen, and Melanie burst into the room, her eyes wide with alarm.
"Scarlet, the baby isn't..."
Scarlet burrowed her head in the dusty upholstery and screamed again.
"Ashley, he's so mean, so doggone mean, so hateful."
"Oh, Ashley, what have you done to her?" Melanie threw herself on the floor beside the sofa and gathered Scarlet into her arms.
"What have you said? How could you? You might bring on the baby. There, my darling, put your head on Melanie's shoulder. What is wrong? Ashley, he's so bullheaded and hateful. Ashley, I'm surprised at you. Upsetting her so much and in her condition, and Mr. O'Hara hardly in his grave."
"Don't you fuss at him," cried Scarlet illogically, raising her head abruptly from Melanie's shoulder, her coarse black hair tumbling out from its net, and her face streaked with tears.
"He's got a right to do as he pleases."
"Melanie," said Ashley, his face white, "let me explain. Scarlet was kind enough to offer me a position in Atlanta as manager of one of her mills."
"Manager?" cried Scarlet indignantly. "I offered him a half interest and he..."
"And I told her. I had already made arrangements for us to go north and she..."
"Oh," cried Scarlet, beginning to sob again. "I told him and told him how much I needed him. How I couldn't get anybody to manage the mill. How I was going to have this baby and he refused to come. And now I'll have to sell the mill, and I know I can't get anything like a good price for it, and I'll lose money. And I guess maybe we'll starve. But he won't care. He's so mean."
She burrowed her head back into Melanie's thin shoulder, and some of the real anguish went from her as a flicker of hope woke in her. She could sense that in Melanie's devoted heart she had an ally. Feel Melanie's indignation that anyone, even her beloved husband, should make Scarlet cry. Melanie flew at Ashley like a small, determined dove and pecked him for the first time in her life.
"Ashley, how could you refuse her? And after all she's done for us, how ungrateful you make us appear. And she's so helpless now with the baby.
How unchivalrous of you! She helped us when we needed help, and now you deny her when she needs you. Scarlet peeped slyly at Ashley, and saw surprise and uncertainty plain in his face as he looked into Melanie's dark, indignant eyes. Scarlet was surprised, too, at the vigor of Melanie's attack, for she knew Melanie considered her husband beyond wifely reproaches, and thought his decision second only to God's. "Melanie," he began, and then threw out his hands helplessly. "Ashley, how can you hesitate? Think what she's done for us, for me. I'd have died in Atlanta when Beau came if it hadn't been for her. And she, yes, she killed a Yankee defending us. Did you know that? She killed a man for us. And she worked and slaved before you and Will came home just to keep food in our mouths. And when I think of her plowing and picking cotton, I could just... Oh, my darling." And she swooped her head and kissed Scarlet's tumbled hair in fierce loyalty. "And now the first time she asks us to do something for her... You don't need to tell me what she has done for us. And Ashley, just think. Besides helping her, just think what it'll mean for us to live in Atlanta among our own people and not have to live with Yankees. There'll be Auntie and Uncle Henry and all our friends, and Beau can have lots of playmates and go to school. If we went north, we couldn't let him go to school and associate with Yankee children and have pickaninnies in his class. We'd have to have a governess, and I don't see how we'd afford... Melanie," said Ashley, and his voice was deadly quiet. "Do you really want to go to Atlanta so badly? You never said so when we talked about going to New York. You never intimated." "Oh, but when we talked about going to New York, I thought there was nothing for you in Atlanta, and besides, it wasn't my place to say anything. It's a wife's duty to go where her husband goes. But now that Scarlet needs us so and has a position that only you can fill, we can go home. Home." Her voice was rapturous as she squeezed Scarlet. "And I'll see Five Points again and Peachtree Road and oh, how I've missed them all. And maybe we could have a little home of our own. I wouldn't care how little and tacky it was, but a home of our own." Her eyes blazed with enthusiasm and happiness, and the two stared at her. Ashley with a queer, stunned look. Scarlet with surprise mingled with shame. It had never occurred to her that Melanie missed Atlanta so much, and longed to be back, longed for a home of her own. She had seemed so contented at Terra, it came to Scarlet as a shock that she was homesick. "Oh, Scarlet, how good of you to plan all this for us. You knew how I longed for home." As usual, when confronted by Melanie's habit of attributing worthy motives where no worth existed, Scarlet was ashamed and irritated. And suddenly, she couldn't meet either Ashley's or Melanie's eyes. "We could get a little house of our own. Do you realize that we've been married 5 years and never had a home? You can stay with us at Aunt Pitty's. That's your home," mumbled Scarlet, toying with a pillow and keeping her eyes down to hide dawning triumph in them as she felt the tide turning her way. "No, but thank you just the same, darling. That would crowd us so. We'll get us a house. Oh, Ashley, do say yes." "Scarlet," said Ashley, and his voice was toneless. "Look at me." Startled, she looked up and met gray eyes that were bitter and full of tired futility. "Scarlet, I will come to Atlanta. I cannot fight you both." He turned and walked out of the room. Some of the triumph in her heart was dulled by a nagging fear. The look in his eyes when he spoke had been the same as when he said he would be lost forever if he came to Atlanta.
After Sue Ellen and Will married, and Corrine went off to Charleston to the convent, Ashley, Melanie, and Beau came to Atlanta, bringing Dilsey with them to cook and nurse. Prissy and Pork were left at Terra until such a time as Will could get other darkies to help him in the fields, and then they, too, would come to town. The little brick house that Ashley took for his family was on Ivy Street, directly behind Aunt Pitty's house, and the two backyards ran together, divided only by a ragged, overgrown privet hedge. Melanie had chosen it especially for this reason. She said, on the first morning of her return to Atlanta, as she laughed and cried and embraced Scarlett and Aunt Pitty, she had been separated from her loved ones for so long that she could never be close enough to them again. The house had originally been two stories high, but the upper floor had been destroyed by shells during the siege, and the owner, returning after the surrender, had lacked the money to replace it. He had contented himself with putting a flat roof on the remaining first floor, which gave the building the squat, disproportionate look of a child's playhouse built of shoeboxes. The house was high from the ground, built over a large cellar, and the long, sweeping flight of stairs which reached it made it look slightly ridiculous. But the flat, squashed look of the place was partly redeemed by the two fine old oaks which shaded it, and a dusty-leaved magnolia, splotched with white blossoms, standing beside the front steps. The lawn was wide and green with thick clover, and bordering it was a straggling, unkempt privet hedge, interlaced with sweet-smelling honeysuckle vines. Here and there in the grass, roses threw out sprangles from crushed old stems, and pink and white crepe myrtle bloomed as valiantly as if war had not passed over their heads and Yankee horses gnawed their boughs. Scarlett thought it quite the ugliest dwelling she had ever seen, but to Melanie, 12 Oaks in all its grandeur had not been more beautiful. It was home, and she and Ashley and Beau were at last together under their own roof. India Wilkes came back from Macon, where she and Honey had lived since 1864, and took up residence with her brother, crowding the occupants of the little house. But Ashley and Melanie welcomed her. Times had changed, money was scarce, but nothing had altered the rule of Southern life that families always made room gladly for indigent or unmarried female relatives. Honey had married, and so India said, married beneath her, a coarse Westerner from Mississippi who had settled in Macon. He had a red face and a loud voice and jolly ways. India had not approved of the match, and, not approving, had not been happy in her brother-in-law's home. She welcomed the news that Ashley now had a home of his own, so she could remove herself from uncongenial surroundings and also from the distressing sight of her sister so fatuously happy with a man unworthy of her. The rest of the family privately thought that the giggling and simple-minded Honey had done far better than could be expected, and they marveled that she had caught any man. Her husband was a gentleman and a man of some means, but to India, born in Georgia and reared in Virginia traditions, anyone not from the eastern seaboard was a boor and a barbarian. Probably Honey's husband was as happy to be relieved of her company as she was to leave him, for India was not easy to live with these days. The mantle of spinsterhood was definitely on her shoulders now. She was 25 and looked it, and so there was no longer any need for her to try to be attractive. Her pale, lashless eyes looked directly and uncompromisingly upon the world, and her thin lips were ever set in haughty tightness. There was an air of dignity and pride about her now that, oddly enough, became her better than the determined girlish sweetness of her days at 12 Oaks. The position she held was almost that of a widow. Everyone knew that Stuart Tarleton would have married her had he not been killed at Gettysburg, and so she was accorded the respect due a woman who had been wanted,
if not wed. The six rooms of the little house on Ivy Street were soon scantily furnished with the cheapest pine and oak furniture in Frank's store, for as Ashley was penniless and forced to buy on credit, he refused anything except the least expensive and bought only the barest necessities. This embarrassed Frank, who was fond of Ashley, and it distressed Scarlett. Both she and Frank would willingly have given, without any charge, the finest mahogany and carved rosewood in the store. But the Wilkeses obstinately refused. Their house was painfully ugly and bare, and Scarlett hated to see Ashley living in the uncarpeted, uncurtained rooms. But he didn't seem to notice his surroundings. And Melanie, having her own home for the first time since her marriage, was so happy, she was actually proud of the place. Scarlett would have suffered agonies of humiliation at having friends find her without draperies and carpets and cushions and the proper number of chairs and teacups and spoons. But Melanie did the honors of her house as though plush curtains and brocade sofas were hers. For all her obvious happiness, Melanie was not well. Little Beau had cost her her health, and the hard work she had done at Terra since his birth had taken further toll of her strength. She was so thin that her small bones seemed ready to come through her white skin. Seen from a distance, romping about the backyard with her child, she looked like a little girl, for her waist was unbelievably tiny, and she had practically no figure. She had no bust, and her hips were as flat as little Beau's. And as she had neither the pride nor the good sense, so Scarlett thought, to sew ruffles in the bosom of her basque or pads on the back of her corsets, her thinness was very obvious. Like her body, her face was too thin and too pale, and her silky brows, arched and delicate as a butterfly's feelers, stood out too blackly against her colorless skin. In her small face, her eyes were too large for beauty, the dark smudges under them making them appear enormous, but the expression in them had not altered since the days of her unworried girlhood. War and constant pain and hard work had been powerless against their sweet tranquility. They were the eyes of a happy woman, a woman around whom storms might blow without ever ruffling the serene core of her being. How did she keep her eyes that way, thought Scarlett, looking at her enviously. She knew her own eyes sometimes had the look of a hungry cat. What was it Rhett had said once about Melanie's eyes? Some foolishness about them being like candles. Oh, yes, like two good deeds in a naughty world. Yes, they were like candles. Candles shielded from every wind. Two soft lights glowing with happiness at being home again among her friends. The little house was always full of company. Melanie had been a favorite, even as a child, and the town flocked to welcome her home again. Everyone brought presents for the house, bric-a-brac, pictures, a silver spoon or two, linen pillowcases, napkins, rag rugs, small articles which they had saved from Sherman and treasured, but which they now swore were of no earthly use to them. Old men who had campaigned in Mexico with her father came to see her, bringing visitors to meet old Colonel Hamilton's sweet daughter. Her mother's old friends clustered about her, for Melanie had a respectful deference to her elders that was very soothing to dowagers in these wild days when young people seemed to have forgotten all their manners. Her contemporaries, the young wives, mothers, and widows, loved her because she had suffered what they had suffered, had not become embittered, and always lent them a sympathetic ear. The young people came as young people always come, simply because they had a good time at her house, and met there the friends they wanted to meet. Around Melanie's tactful and self-effacing person, there rapidly grew up a clique of young and old who represented what was left of the best of Atlanta's antebellum society, all poor in purse, all proud in family. diehards of the stoutest variety. It was as if Atlanta society, scattered and wrecked by war, depleted by death, bewildered by change, had found in her an unyielding nucleus about which it could reform. Melanie was young, but she had in her all the qualities this embattled remnant prized: poverty and pride in poverty, uncomplaining courage, gaiety, hospitality, kindness, and above all, loyalty to all the old traditions. Melanie refused to change, refused even to admit that there was any reason to change in a changing world. Under her roof, the old days seemed to come back again, and people took heart and felt even more contemptuous of the tide of wild life and high living that was sweeping the carpetbaggers and newly rich Republicans along. When they looked into her young face and saw there the inflexible loyalty to the old days, they could forget, for a moment, the traitors within their own class who were causing fury, fear, and heartbreak. And there were many such. There were men of good family, driven to desperation by poverty, who had gone over to the enemy, become Republicans and accepted positions from the conquerors so their families would not be on charity. There were young ex-soldiers who lacked the courage to face the long years necessary to build up fortunes. These youngsters, following the lead of Rhett Butler, went hand in hand with the carpetbaggers in money-making schemes of unsavory kinds. Worst of all the traitors were the daughters of some of Atlanta's most prominent families. These girls who had come to maturity since the surrender had only childish memories of the war and lacked the bitterness that animated their elders. They had lost no husbands, no lovers. They had few recollections of past wealth and splendor. And the Yankee officers were so handsome and finely dressed and so carefree. And they gave such splendid balls and drove such fine horses and simply worshipped Southern girls. They treated them like queens and were so careful not to injure their touchy pride, and, after all, why not associate with them? They were so much more attractive than the town swains who dressed so shabbily and were so serious and worked so hard that they had little time for play. So there had been a number of elopements with Yankee officers which broke the hearts of Atlanta families. There were brothers who passed sisters on the streets and didn't speak, and mothers and fathers who never mentioned daughters' names. Remembering these tragedies, a cold dread ran in the veins of those whose motto was, "No surrender." A dread which the very sight of Melanie's soft but unyielding face dispelled. She was, as the dowagers said, such an excellent and wholesome example to the young girls of the town. And because she made no parade of her virtues, the young girls didn't resent her. It never occurred to Melanie that she was becoming the leader of a new society. She only thought the people were nice to come to see her, and to want her in their little sewing circles, cotillion clubs, and musical societies. Atlanta had always been musical and loved good music, despite the sneering comments of sister cities of the South concerning the town's lack of culture. And there was now an enthusiastic resurrection of interest that grew stronger as the times grew harder and more tense. It was easier to forget the impudent black faces in the streets and the blue uniforms of the garrison while they were listening to music. Melanie was a little embarrassed to find herself at the head of the newly formed Saturday night musical circle. She couldn't account for her elevation to this position except by the fact that she could accompany anyone on the piano, even the Mrs. McClure, who were tone-deaf, but who would sing duets. The truth of the matter was that Melanie had diplomatically managed to amalgamate the Lady Harpists, the Gentlemen's Glee Club, and the Young Ladies Mandolin and Guitar Society with the Saturday Night Musical Circle, so that now Atlanta had music worth listening to. In fact,
The Circle's rendition of The Bohemian Girl was said by many to be far superior to professional performances heard in New York and New Orleans. It was after she had maneuvered the lady harpists into the fold that Mrs. Merriweather said to Mrs. Meade and Mrs. Whiting that they must have Melanie at the head of the Circle. If she could get on with the harpists, she could get on with anyone, Mrs. Merriweather declared. That lady herself played the organ for the choir at the Methodist Church, and as an organist, had scant respect for harps or harpists. Melanie had also been made secretary for both the Association for the Beautification of the Graves of Our Glorious Dead and the Sewing Circle for the Widows and Orphans of the Confederacy. This new honor came to her after an exciting joint meeting of those societies, which threatened to end in violence and the severance of lifelong ties of friendship. The question had arisen at the meeting as to whether or not weeds should be removed from the graves of the Union soldiers near those of Confederate soldiers. The appearance of the scraggly Yankee mounds defeated all the efforts of the ladies to beautify those of their own dead. Immediately the fires which smoldered beneath tight basques flamed wildly, and the two organizations split up and glared hostilely. The Sewing Circle was in favor of the removal of the weeds. The ladies of the beautification were violently opposed. Mrs. Meade expressed the views of the latter group when she said, "Dig up the weeds off Yankee graves. For 2 cents, I'll dig up all the Yankees and throw them in a city dump." At these ringing words, the two associations arose, and every lady spoke her mind, and no one listened. The meeting was being held in Mrs. Merriweather's parlor, and Grandpa Merriweather, who had been banished to the kitchen, reported afterwards that the noise sounded just like the opening guns of the Battle of Franklin. And, he added, he guessed it was a dinged sight safer to be present at the Battle of Franklin than at the ladies' meeting. Somehow Melanie made her way to the center of the excited throng, and somehow made her usually soft voice heard above the tumult. Her heart was in her throat with fright at daring to address the indignant gathering, and her voice shook, but she kept crying, "Ladies, please," till the din died down. "I want to say, I mean, I've thought for a long time that not only should we pull up the weeds, but we should plant flowers on... I don't care what you think, but every time I go to take flowers to dear Charlie's grave, I always put some on the grave of an unknown Yankee, which is nearby. It looks so forlorn." The excitement broke out again in louder words, and this time the two organizations merged and spoke as one. "On Yankee graves! Oh, Melly, how could you? And they killed Charlie. They almost killed you. Why, the Yankees might have killed Beau when he was born. They tried to burn you out of terror." Melanie held on to the back of her chair for support, almost crumpling beneath the weight of a disapproval she had never known before. "Oh, ladies," she cried, pleading, "please let me finish. I know I haven't the right to speak on this matter, for none of my loved ones were killed except Charlie, and I know where he lies, thank God. But there are so many among us today who do not know where their sons and husbands and brothers are buried, and..." She choked, and there was a dead silence in the room. Mrs. Meade's flaming eyes went somber. She had made the long trip to Gettysburg after the battle to bring back Darcy's body, but no one had been able to tell her where he was buried. Somewhere in some hastily dug trench in the enemy's country. And Mrs. Allen's mouth quivered. Her husband and brother had been on that ill-starred raid Morgan made into Ohio, and the last information she had of them was that they fell on the banks of the river just as the Yankee cavalry stormed up. She didn't know where they lay. Mrs. Allison's son had died in a northern prison camp, and she, the poorest of the poor, was unable to bring his body home. There were others who had read on casualty lists.
missing, believed dead. And in those words had learned the last news they were ever to learn of men they had seen march away. They turned to Melanie with eyes that said, "Why do you open these wounds again? These are the wounds that never heal, the wounds of not knowing where they lie." Melanie's voice gathered strength in the stillness of the room. "Their graves are somewhere up in the Yankees' country, just like the Yankee graves are here. And oh, how awful it would be to know that some Yankee woman said to dig them up and..." Mrs. Meade made a small, dreadful sound. "But how nice it would be to know that some good Yankee woman..." "And there must be some good Yankee women. I don't care what people say. They can't all be bad. How nice it would be to know that they pulled weeds off our men's graves and brought flowers to them, even if they were enemies. If Charlie were dead in the North, it would comfort me to know that someone, and I don't care what you ladies think of me..." Her voice broke again. "I will withdraw from both clubs, and I'll pull up every weed off every Yankee's grave I can find, and I'll plant flowers, too, and I just dare anyone to stop me." With his final defiance, Melanie burst into tears and tried to make her stumbling way to the door. Grandpa Merriweather, safe in the masculine confines of the Girl of the Period saloon an hour later, reported to Uncle Henry Hamilton that after these words, everybody cried and embraced Melanie. And it all ended up in a love feast, and Melanie was made secretary of both organizations.
"And they're going to pull up the weeds. The hell of it is, Dolly said I'd be only too pleased to help do it, because I didn't have anything much else to do. I got nothing against the Yankees, and I think Miss Melly was right, and the rest of those lady wildcats wrong. But the idea of me pulling weeds at my time of life and with my lumbago..."
Melanie was on the board of lady managers of the Orphans' Home and assisted in the collection of books for the newly formed Young Men's Library Association. Even the thespians who gave amateur plays once a month clamored for her. She was too timid to appear behind the kerosene lamp footlights, but she could make costumes out of croaker sacks if they were the only material available. It was she who cast the deciding vote at the Shakespeare Reading Circle that the bard's work should be varied with those of Mr. Dickens and Mr. Bulwer Lytton and not the poems of Lord Byron, as had been suggested by a young and, Melanie privately feared, very fast bachelor member of the circle. In the nights of the late summer, her small, feebly lighted house was always full of guests. There were never enough chairs to go around, and frequently ladies sat on the steps of the front porch, with men grouped about them on the banisters, on packing boxes or on the lawn below. Sometimes, when Scarlett saw guests sitting on the grass, sipping tea, the only refreshments the Wilkses could afford, she wondered how Melanie could bring herself to expose her poverty so shamelessly. Until Scarlett was able to furnish Aunt Pitty's house as it had been before the war, and serve her guests good wine and juleps and baked ham and cold haunches of venison, she had no intention of having guests in her home, especially prominent guests such as Melanie had. General John B. Gordon, Georgia's great hero, was frequently there with his family. Father Ryan, the poet-priest of the Confederacy, never failed to call when passing through Atlanta. He charmed gatherings there with his wit, and seldom needed much urging to recite The Sword of Lee or his deathless Concord Banner, which never failed to make the ladies cry. Alex Stevens, late vice president of the Confederacy, visited whenever in town, and when the word went about that he was at Melanie's, the house was filled, and people sat for hours under the spell of the frail invalid with the ringing voice. Usually, there were a dozen children present, nodding sleepily in their parents' arms, up hours after their normal bedtime. No family wanted its children to miss being able to say, in after years, that they had been kissed by the great vice president, or had shaken the hand that helped to guide the cause. Every person of importance who came to town found his way to the Wilkes home, and often they spent the night there. It crowded the little flat-topped house, forced India to sleep on a pallet in the cubbyhole that was Beau's nursery, and sent Dilsey speeding through the back hedge to borrow breakfast eggs from Aunt Pitty's cookie. But Melanie entertained them as graciously as if hers was a mansion. No, it did not occur to Melanie that people rallied round her, as round a worn and loved standard. And so she was both astounded and embarrassed when Dr. Meade, after a pleasant evening at her house, where he acquitted himself nobly in reading the part of Macbeth, kissed her hand and made observations in the voice he once used in speaking of our glorious cause. "My dear Miss Melly, it is always a privilege and a pleasure to be in your home, for you, and ladies like you, are the hearts of all of us, all that we have left. They have taken the flower of our manhood and the laughter of our young women. They have broken our health, uprooted our lives, and unsettled our habits. They have ruined our prosperity, set us back 50 years, and placed too heavy a burden on the shoulders of our boys who should be in school, and our old men who should be sleeping in the sun. But we will build back, because we have hearts like yours to build upon. And as long as we have them, the Yankees can have the rest." Until Scarlett's figure reached such proportions that even Aunt Pitty's big black shawl did not conceal her condition, she and Frank frequently slipped through the back hedge to join the summer night gatherings on Melanie's porch. Scarlett always sat well out of the light, hidden in the protecting shadows where she was not only inconspicuous but could unobserved.